The following lecture is provided by Biblical Training. The speaker is Dr. Timothy Tennant. More information is available at www.biblicaltraining.org.
The fifth and final pillar is pilgrimage, the Hajj. And this is yet another obligation for the Muslims to sometime during his or her lifetime to go on a pilgrimage to the Holy Kaaba in Mecca. This is designed to be a reenactment of the Abrahamic pilgrimage, which the Quran claims that Abraham made with Ishmael, as well as Muhammad's own pilgrimage there. It's interesting because Muslims claim that they do not have any sacraments, and yet there's a lot of sacramental aspects to a lot of these things, and certainly the pilgrimage falls into this category. The rationale is found in several places in the Quran, including Surah 2, 196 to 203, and Surah 5, 98 to 100. It's found in both of those passages. Let me just read you a couple of those accounts and give you a feel for this, if you haven't already read this. Make the pilgrimage and visit the sacred house. Of course, that refers to the Kaaba, for his sake. If you cannot, send such offerings as you can afford, and do not shave your heads until the offerings have reached their destination. Okay, this is, again, the practice as you go. You go through a cleansing, which involves the shaving of your head. That's he refers to that there in passing. The 10th day, this occurs on the 12th month. The 10th day of the 12th month, even if you're not in the on the pilgrimage, then there is a special sacrifice and a special kind of celebration that goes on to mark that in the Muslim world. The Eid al-Adha. This is the special celebration which involves the sacrifice of an animal, a ram or a lamb, whose mouth is open towards Mecca. And so, you have a strong Jewish practice of this. When I was in Eastern Europe, I was there during the 12th month, 10th day, and the streets were filled with people buying these animals to go home and sacrifice and kill them. So it's something that is definitely observed. There, like with the Salat, there are various aspects of the pilgrimage. First of all, the pilgrimage is designed specifically to visit the Kaaba. That's the main thing that you have to do, is actually visit this central shrine, not just to go to Mecca, but particularly to go to the Kaaba. Again, in Surah 3, 97, he says, "The first temple ever to be built for men was that at Mecca, a blessed place, a beacon for the nations. In it there are veritable signs, and the spot where Abraham stood. Whoever enters it is safe. Pilgrimage to the house is a duty to Allah for all who can make the journey." So this is part of the pilgrimage, is to visit this once in your lifetime. So you have, notice the variation of times. You have the prayers, in a kind of purist sense, five times a day. You have the fasting, which is 1 month per year. And then you have the pilgrimage, which is once in your lifetime. So these are kind of regular regenerative events that will direct the Muslim's life. When you get to the Kaaba, there are several features that occur in order to fulfill the obligations, and it's truly called a proper pilgrimage. And you'll see that I have here on the handout the six major features of the pilgrimage. To be fair, there are many variations of these six, and there are many pilgrimages that they sponsor that they call them greater pilgrimages, lesser pilgrimages, which would include many more things. One of the biggest things for that matter is actually a visit to the temple in Jerusalem. So it's not at all unusual to see people on pilgrimage to Mecca if you go to Jerusalem. Has anybody seen Muslim pilgrims in Jerusalem? I'm just curious. Many of you have never been to Jerusalem. If you're there during the Hajj. Were you there during the Hajj? Did you see Muslims on pilgrimage to Mecca via Jerusalem? Do you remember that? If you're there all year long, you're bound to see them, right? But there, a lot of Muslims will plan a lot of other holy sites as a part of the Hajj. So the since Jerusalem is the most important site outside of the Muslim world, more wealthy Muslims will include a wider orbit of things to see and do. So what I'm giving you is more or less the bare bones. What is the essential qualities of a true Hajj? And it must occur during the appropriate month, and it must incorporate certain kinds of things. The first is the haram, which is the consecration. The pilgrim arrives at Mecca. They call this the axis mundi, the destiny of the Qibla. It is the point where all the Qiblas in the whole world point to. And so when you arrive there, you must enter into a state of consecration. This means, as we read in the Quran, a shaving of the head and putting on a white garment that supposedly makes no distinction between you and any other Muslim. So technically, whether a Muslim from Nowheresville is going to the Kaaba, or for example, when someone like a famous Muslim like Yasser Arafat a few years ago, he was in the news when he made pilgrimage to the Kaaba. When Yasser Arafat went, what is the one thing about Arafat's clothing that you always recognize? Okay, he always wears a certain thing, right? This kind of checkerboard cloth thing he wears, all right? Now, when he went, that had to be discarded. And so they have a photograph, I've never seen it before or since, of Yasser Arafat completely bald-headed. The guy doesn't have one strand of hair on his head, all right? So, in fact, the caption was, bareheaded before God. Because he does not show his head. I've never seen his head in public. I mean, his bare head in public. It's always covered up. And so the idea was, this was shown in the Muslim world, even Yasser Arafat, bears all before Allah. Okay, the fact they're following him around with a camera means he was not getting the same attention as ordinary Joe, but we won't, put boohoo on everything. But the white robe is supposed to symbolize the equality of all humans before Allah. This is in day one of the pilgrimage. So that's the first thing. Still on the first day, you enter what's called the Tawaf, the circumambulation of the Kaaba. The term circumambulation refers to the encirclement of a holy place. This is a very important term, again, in Judaism as well as in Christianity. We'll take some time. I don't know, maybe we should go ahead and do it while we're on the subject. Psalm 26, verse 6. It'll save us time if we do it now. You'll notice that in the Psalms, the Jewish practice, you have them circling the temple during the Feast of Tabernacles. So this is, again, a precedent that Muhammad is familiar with in the Jewish context. They travel and they make seven circumambulations counterclockwise through the Kaaba. Now this is a large, as you know, the Kaaba is this large stone cubic structure, about 40 feet long, 30 feet wide, and about 50 feet high. It's actually higher than you would think. 40 by 30, it's a pretty big building, but it's not that big when you have that many people going through it. So it's covered with a black cloth, which is with verses from the Quran embroidered on it. And the only Muslims are allowed into the Kaaba. So, and into Mecca in general, for that matter. There's no non-Muslim allowed into Mecca. It's a haram. It's a, remember this term, haram, that we looked at earlier. This is a sacred place. Now, in the Kaaba, in the southern corner of the Kaaba, there is a the southeastern corner, there is the black stone, which we've already referred to in the course. The black stone is kept there. There's a term for this part of the Kaaba. Just drawn a blank, but it's not an important term. But they have a special term for this part of the Kaaba. But that's where the black stone is. And the black stone is encased in a solid silver kind of donut-shaped thing that kind of goes like this around it, because it's actually being held together because it's during several wars, it's been burst into pieces. So it's there for you to kiss. The ideal point is that you would kiss the black stone, which a guy like, again, Yasser Arafat, in that picture, it's that picture of him with the bald head is him at the moment when he kisses the black stone. Now, because of the crowds, it is not possible to everyone to get that close to the black stone. And therefore, the provision is made that if you are not able to kiss it or touch it, you should at least gesture toward it. So most Muslims that go on pilgrimage, it's very likely they would never have actual contact with the black stone. They would merely gesture toward it as a gesture toward this symbol of monotheism. So that's a big part of the highlight of the Hajj is this circumambulation. You are you're barefoot. You're in the white robe. They are claiming that this is not an act of worship to the black stone. Obviously, it goes against everything Islam believes in. This is simply an acknowledgement of the antiquity of monotheism and the historic tie with Abraham that the Muslims claim is so important. In that sense, it's very, very important. So that's the first two features of the Hajj. The third feature is a side, this hastening between Safa and Marwa. This is a point where the pilgrims will run seven times. Again, notice the number seven popping out. They circumambulate seven times. They do the hastening seven times. Between Safa and Marwa, these are two small hills in Mecca. And they are to hasten back and forth between these two small hills. The purpose of the hastening is to remember the frantic search that Hagar went through when she was searching for water for her son Ishmael. You remember, of course, this is a passage, again, directly out of the Old Testament where Hagar goes through this rebuke in the Old Testament context, but nevertheless, this concern about her son. And there is a well from which they believe is the one that Hagar drank from and saved Ishmael's life. It's called the Zamzam. Is that on here? I don't believe it is, but anyway, it's called the Zamzam. This is the well, and if you can drink from that well, it's going to be a wonderful thing. But they hasten seven times between them, and that has been, by the way, the cause of the death of more Muslims on pilgrimage than any other thing is this hastening. Because you're supposed to run back and forth between this. And so with the large crowds, a number of Muslims have been trampled to death. Every year, Muslims are killed during the hastening. And so you'd be very, very careful, because it's like the famous bull run in Spain. It's a problem. In fact, there was a number of years ago where there was it's been now maybe 8 or 9 years ago, there was a lot of Muslims killed during this time. It was the most they ever had. It was over 100 people were trampled to death during this time, like 103 or something like that. So because the number was so high, it made international news. Over 100 people trampled to death on Hajj. So they interviewed the chief mullah who oversees. They asked him, they said, how do you explain the fact these people were coming to worship Allah and perform their annual or their once in a lifetime pilgrimage to get trampled to death? And he said it was this dramatic testimony to predestination. He said in the article, he said, we believe that all 103 of those people would have died at that exact instant wherever they were in the world. They just happened to be on pilgrimage at the time of their death, but Allah had willed that they die at that moment. Even Calvin would blush at that. I mean, that is just unabashed kind of hyper views of predestination. But that kind of thing comes through. In fact, there's a passage in the Hadith. I don't think it's in the collection you have, but in the Hadith where Umar, one of the caliphs that followed Muhammad, tells a story that is now in a sacred Hadith, which says that the day before the battle of Badr, where the Muslims have this famous battle we looked at earlier in the course, and Sunni Muslims were killed, that Muhammad walked on the battlefield. And according to Umar, Muhammad said to him, this is where so-and-so will die. This is where so-and-so will die. This is where so-and-so will die. And he showed him where everybody would die. And the next day they had the battle. And when they went to get the bodies, all the bodies were in the exact same place as Muhammad had said. Again, he asked him, why do you know? Umar asked him, how do you know they'll die in this place? Because, he said, it's Allah's will they fall at that place. So that mentality has carried through to the present day. Very, very strict, especially in Sunni, not so much in Shia, but in Sunni Islam, the main branch of Islam, this is there. Finally, on the end of the first day, this is still the first day, the Muslim goes 13 miles out of the city to the plain of Arafat and listens to sermons on the site of Muhammad's last sermon. And the pilgrim is supposed to stand in devotion. The other part of the pilgrimage happens by noon. Then you're transported out. You have the noonday prayer. You're transported out to the plains of Arafat. You hear the sermons. And, of course, you have your prayers from the noonday, the late afternoon prayer and the sunset prayer, an evening and sunset prayer, the three prayers while you're there. And according to Muhammad, again, I'm quoting the Hadith, the best of prayers is the prayer of the day of Arafat. And so it's going to be a very special thing to perform Salat on the plains of Arafat. This is where they believe Muhammad gave his last sermons. So those are the main elements of the first day of pilgrimage. And that is the absolute necessity. That is about 5 miles out, they know the Arafat's 13 miles out, but they also come back to a place called Muzdalifa, which is about 5 miles away from that, where they usually have these huge tent cities where literally thousands of Muslims will spend the night in these erected tent cities. And they have a huge bus system that, you know, transports people. It's a huge logistical issue, you can imagine. Of getting that many Muslims in and out of that city in 1 month's time is a remarkable feat. And they have, they claim, I haven't read this in non-Muslim article journals, but they claim that the planes in the airport in Riyadh and other major cities in Saudi Arabia, the planes are landing like every 30 seconds. These are like 747s. Landing every 30 seconds, for the entire month, day and night. Either landing or taking off. So, you know, I don't know what the numbers are. The numbers vary, people's estimates. But we're talking about millions of people who make the pilgrimage to Mecca. And I think it wouldn't compare to some of the Hindu festivals. We saw recently the major Hindu festival where the Hindus go out to this festival where they dip in the, and that was the largest gathering of humanity in the history of the world. You had millions of Hindus in one particular spot dipping in the Ganges River, but that only comes, that particular festival only occurs over every 100 years. So this is a little different than this annual event. So if you accumulate annually the number of people going to Mecca, it's extremely high. In the ancient world, of course, it was mainly people from Saudi Arabia who went. And then there was centuries where African Muslims would lived and died and never went on pilgrimage. And that became a point of dispute among Muslims, whether African Muslims could be true Muslims when they never could go on pilgrimage. But there was no way for an African to get to Mecca. It just simply wasn't possible. And so it is in the modern period with air travel that it's a very, very big thing. The American Muslims going to Mecca is relatively recent. When Malcolm X, for example, had his famous conversion not only to the Nation of Islam, but later in his life, he converted to mainstream Islam before his assassination. Well, Malcolm X wanted to go on pilgrimage. And they said to him, "You can't, because you're an American. Americans can't come to Mecca." And because the idea of American Muslim, this is 1960s. It was just not really on the consciousness of people in Arabia that there's such an animal as an American Muslim. And so they said to Malcolm X, "You can only come if you provide," which is, by the way, the standard procedure. If your heritage is in doubt, you have to provide a letter of recommendation from your Muslim cleric that would say, Malcolm X is a member in good standing in this mosque. He's a faithful Muslim, et cetera, and he can go on pilgrimage." And he was allowed to go, and he went. But it's not really until our generation that we're seeing the real dramatic multinational Hajj is going on. This is a dramatic development, I think, is mainly because of air travel. It's now made possible. So you have people from all over the world today participate in the Hajj, not just people from the immediate vicinity and the countries right around Saudi Arabia. So that's the first day. We wake up the next morning to call to prayer, naturally. We will be faithful about keeping our times of prayer, naturally, on the Hajj. On the second day, the tradition is to travel via bus, usually, from Mecca up to Medina. And we mentioned already that these are the two twin cities of Arabian Peninsula, Mecca and Medina, on the west coast of Arabia. And Medina is important for a number of reasons. One of the biggest, most famous mosques in the country is located in Medina, or two of them actually. One is the place where Muhammad prayed the very first time and performed Salat after the Hijra. The mosque where Muhammad changed the Qibla and focused from Jerusalem to Mecca. That happens in Medina. And also the tomb of the Prophet, where Muhammad is buried in Medina. So these are very important sites to visit, these mosques and the place of Muhammad's burial. So that's a very significant part of the Hajj. But those are not the traditional things that are emphasized by Muhammad, obviously, since he was alive when this was being taught. So the main purpose of visiting Medina, or going toward Medina, is the first stop is a place called Mina, M-I-N-A. And this is a place on the way from Mecca up to Medina. It's just a few miles out. The first stop is a place where Muslims believe that Ishmael's sacrifice was to have taken place. Now, as you know, this is the traditional site on the Dome of the Rock in Jerusalem. The Jews believe that Abraham sacrificed Isaac and was stopped by the angel and had the substitutionary lamb, Jehovah Jireh, and all of that. But according to Muslim tradition, it took place in Mina, and there are three pillars there of three different sizes. And these are the three places that Satan tempted Ishmael to rebel against his father. And according to their belief, Ishmael threw stones at the devil. And so the second day involves throwing stones at these pillars. And you cry out, "Allahu Akbar, God is great, Allahu Akbar." And you throw stones at the devil. So you have some dramatic pictures of thousands of Muslims throwing stones at a pillar. And these stones, of course, are collected and brought back out so that you won't cover up the pillars with all the stones being thrown at them. But this is a tradition. The third day, you can, again, if it's the Greater Hajj, you can go out to Medina and see those sites. Otherwise, you come back into Mecca itself and you repeat the sevenfold circumambulation and the seven jogs or hastening between Safa and Marwa. You have a final cleansing, your hair again shaved, You put on ordinary clothes and you are spiritually reborn. This is a term that they have that is added to your name, Al-Haji, or if you are a woman, it's Al-Hajjah, which basically is a new title to your name. So if you have been on the Hajj, you're allowed to add this as a, you know, a postscript to your name, as an honorific title. It's like being called Reverend or Doctor or whatever. It's an honorific type title that you add to your name to let people know that you have made pilgrimage to Mecca. As I said before, this is what I've given you basically is the three-day bare-bones trip, which you go up to Mecca. Pretty much everything happens in Mecca. But many people do the 13-day tour, 13-day Hajj, which would involve the time in Mecca as well. Mecca, Medina, as well as what they call the, what their term is Al-Aqsa, this is their term for the Dome of the Rock, the farthest mosque. And that is known as the Greater Hajj. So, this is the gist of the fivefold prayers. And it gives you some sense for the importance of this in upholding the House of Islam. We mentioned that Islam is held up by five pillars, the House of Islam, and we've surveyed the basic five pillars of Islam. I'm quoting an early Muslim leader that's in the Hadith. Prayer carries us halfway to God. Fasting brings us to the door of His praises. Almsgiving procures for us admission. Tremendous testimony to the role of the fivefold or the five pillars of Islam in moving the Muslim closer to Allah. So Islam, though they boast of having no sacraments, all five of these are very sacramental in nature, some more than others. But if you call a sacrament a visible sign of an inward grace or the corporate aspect of sacramental work, worship, and sacramental ministry in the lives of believers, there is a lot of solidarity that is done when you have prayers where everyone's facing the same direction all over the world. That's sacramental, in its flavor at least. Everyone going, you know, on pilgrimage together with a common white garment, etc. This is very sacramental in its tone. So I think what we would argue at this point is that the genius of Islam is certainly not in its originality, in ideas or practice. I don't really think that's a major dispute. I think Muhammad seems to be quite free, even in the Quran itself, of acknowledging his interaction with Jews and Christians and others that were present on the Arabian Peninsula. I think the genius of Islam is in the creative assimilation of Jewish and Christian practice into a new religion that when you put it all together, it carries a distinctively new tone and expression. And I think that is really where we find the key to this.
Thank you for listening to this lecture brought to you by biblicaltraining.org. Feel free to make copies of this lecture to give to others, but please do not charge for these copies or alter the content in any way without permission. We invite you to visit our website at www.biblicaltraining.org. There you will find the finest in evangelical teaching for use in the home and the church, and it is absolutely free. Our curriculum includes classes for new believers, lay education classes, and seminary-level classes taught by some of the finest seminary teachers drawn from a wide range of evangelical traditions. Our mailing address is Post Office Box 28428, Spokane, Washington, 99228, USA.